सुखिनः।
UK House Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
I'm truly excited to be the bridge between medical experts and you. I'm here to help you take charge of your health. It can be quite difficult to navigate the maze of information about health, which often can be too scientific or oversimplified. And at times, it is just the latest fad. I'm here to guide you, take informed choices. I'm truly excited, delighted, and very grateful to be with Maya Tiwari for the very first series of Unlock Your Health. Maya Tiwari is a world-renowned health educator. She started Inner Medicine, which we are going to be talking about very soon, what that is. Maya Tiwari has helped thousands of people across the world, and she started the very first school to educate people how to use food to heal ourselves, and she called it Wise Earth Ayurveda. I'm very thankful to you, Maya, for coming to this show and sharing your journey from being a very successful fashion designer in the 1970s in Madison Avenue, and then something happened in your life. Everything changed. And that became the path of your life, which has not only changed your life, it has changed lives of many people around the world. So in this series, we are going to be talking about how diagnosis of cancer, ovarian cancer, completely changed the path of a very successful young fashion designer to take on the path of giving the key to unlock people's health. Maya, often you talk to me and you say, cancer was a transformer of your life.
Vijay, it is a pleasure to be here with you today. Thank you. To be on Unblock Your Health at your premiere show. And I wish you all success with it.
Thank you so much.
Cancer is a transformer. Cancer digs deep. There is no way we can escape going within the sanctuary of ourselves in order to find the answers, no matter how good our physicians are and how advanced scientific medical therapies have become. In my case, as you said, I was a fashion designer, very successful at a very young age, alongside Halston and many others, Oscar de la Rente, Jeffrey Bean, all of these chaps were in the industry at the time with huge salons. I had already created not only the store on Madison Avenue, but had started a franchise package where Maya stores were being put into some of the high fashion retailers around the country, like I. Magnin's, Neiman Marcus, Bloomingdale's, Henri Bendel, all of these stores.
How old were you then?
Very young, actually, but the industry didn't know that because I had gone to secondhand stores and bought the Balenciaga dresses that I absolutely loved and tailored myself to look more mature than I actually was. I was 16 when I started out in the fashion industry, and we'll talk about how I came to New York, but that's a very different story. Right now, I came to a study decided that it was more intriguing at that time to do. I had hidden memories of being a designer. We all have those largesse if we know how to find them. But the fact is not age so much as I accomplished a job and moved on. But then at the age of 18 or 19, going on 19, I was struck with ovarian cancer.
So I want to stop you here for a moment because ovarian cancer then and even now is a type of cancer that's very elusive. That's difficult to detect because the symptoms are very vague. It can be tiredness. It can be abdominal pain or indigestion. It's not like breast cancer where actually one can detect it early. But ovarian cancer is comparatively a rare type of cancer. And depending on the stages of the cancer, it can be very aggressive, can be very severe. And also the survival rate, even after golden standard treatments, are not that bright. And I can only imagine the plight of a young woman at the peak of her career diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And at a time when we didn't have so much research, we didn't have so many options to deal with, forget ovarian cancer. And what happened?
Yeah, towards the late 70s, the development, as you said, was very scanty. I had no clue what the difference between ovarian cancer, breast cancer, or brain cancer was right at that time. And when I was given that diagnosis, even my oncologist in New York was not certain that it could possibly be that diagnosis. So he sent my files on to Johns Hopkins and Memorial Hospital and a few others in order to really diagnose it. It was a rare form of ovarian carcinoma. Mm-hmm. And they had not seen the likes of which in a very, very long time. But needless to say, it got the attention of my oncologist, who was at the first in New York Hospital was where I started out, and then I then shifted on to Mount Sinai Hospital, where my main oncologist was. He was a brilliant man, a brilliant doctor. He was on the cutting edge of a treatment with platinum and adriamycin at the time. It was the first introduced therapy that had some sign of success with ovarian cancer. And I did, you know, at that time, I had available to me the best of medical help in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And through many good friends and my contacts that I had made in the fashion and acting industry as well, I did study with Stella Adler concurrently in my fashion years. But I could tell that they thought it was shocking and sort of a doomsday scenario by their attitude to me. It was extremely kind. Mm-hmm. And extremely loving and almost preparing me from day one for the inevitable factor of dying. But they did fight like warriors to get the disease out of the body, and I did take several rounds of chemotherapy. I did endure 12 major surgeries, not only with a complete hysterectomy, which was first off because the tumor was found in the ovaries, and a radical hysterectomy was suggested, which I conceded to. And
so a radical hysterectomy is where the entire uterus and the ovaries are all removed.
Leaving a vacuumous space, which later I would understand needed to be filled with incredible love. But as we started out, the 7 of the surgeries were actually to keep removing
the tumor,
lesions and other unfavorable conditions. Yeah. I also had an amazing gynecologist who really had the hands of a sculptor. I have such a thin hairline scar after 12 major openings. Mm-hmm. That was a horizontal scar. In those years, they used to do vertical scars. Yeah. And leave.
It was very new to do horizontal incision.
Yes, and so the grace of the divine grace was with me all the way. When we got to radiation, because I also took a series of radiation therapy, unfortunately, that metastasize the cells to the lymph.
As an adverse effect?
Yes, as an adverse effect. It did not work. And it not only didn't work, but the cancer was no longer contained within the vacuum of my womb. It was now in the lymph. And at that point, they were really scrambling for what could possibly be done to reverse it. More exploratory surgeries, and then the understanding that I need to get in touch with my parents,
mm-hmm.
and make my peace with my family. And morphine was the suggested recommendation for me. And that sentence of 6 months to live.
Mm-hmm. So what was going through you? Because I have known you in the last few years in a completely different role, where you are helping women and people in general how to look after their health through food. And is it 40 years now since that incident?
It's like 42 years since my survival, and never once any reoccurrence.
Yeah, what really kind of made me very interested in your story, Maya, mm-hmm. for me is, as a young doctor, I was researching on cancer of the cervix. And these women, they were sent to pain clinics. Some of them were abandoned from family because of the complications, and they didn't know how to deal with. And that's when I thought, maybe along with conventional care, there are other paradigms that might help improve their quality of life. What I see is that's a completely different clinical scenario for me. But talking to you, I'd like to know, you found your own ways to come around this huge challenge.
And we can't as individuals take credit on that, Vijay, because there are so many masters. Medicine has so much that helps us. And holistic ways have so much more that can do it. But if you are young and basically not so in tune, at that time I wasn't so in tune to the holistic path of health, although I was brought up in a Hindu Brahmin family and knew the ways of the earth. My grandfather was an incredible farmer, or organic farmer. We didn't call it organic in those years because it simply was natural farming. But what happened when I was given the death sentence, I think like any human person, you become shocked. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a shock and awe effect. You're not really sure that you're in your body. In any event, after 12 major operations, I probably wasn't in my body and floating about. But there was another thing which brings in a whole other story, and we can just touch on it right now, and that is my people were being exported, as it were, from our country in Guyana. It was British Guyana. It had just earned independence. The civil wars broke out. And at the same time that cancer was raging war within me, they were fighting the waging war of the civil war in their country and being exported to Canada.
So do you see parallels?
There are parallels there, because what happens in our physiological body is not only reflective of what is going on in the psychological state of our own selves, our family, and our collective community. It always is a mirroring of inside, outside, within, without. But my thing was, I didn't want to belabor my family with my cancer diagnosis, because they had already had a war and leaving their wealth and homes and farms and an exquisite life with the shirts on their backs. And so for me, my doctor became the father figure. The oncologist was an amazing man. He took a personal interest in me. And this may amuse you. I was a very determined young woman even then. Mm-hmm. Obviously had to become a fashion designer at 16 and get away with it. But the basic thing is that I remember at 4 a.m. one morning, an injection being plunked into my buttocks. I was so rudely awakened in the hospital and was so offended by the fact that that could happen. So the next day I called some friends of mine who were Italian Americans that come in and secretly put a lock on my hospital door. It had never happened before, apparently, in the hospital, and much to the chagrin of the staff that came in the early morning to get in, they couldn't get in, lock on my door, and my oncologist was called in very early that day to try and talk me through the unlocking of the door.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a tenacious patient as well that was trying furtively to protect my human rights even then. So I knew that there was a spirit inside of me
mm-hmm.
that was the warrior. What I didn't know then was that it would become a spiritual warrior.
So how did that paradigm shift came about? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I understand that you started to reflect a lot about what was happening in your family, in the country where you were born, and your life.
Never lost sight of it, Vijay, because it was the strident factor under my cancer in the first place. It had gone unfound for generations, and like most of our culture in those days, cancer had the kind of stigma and phobia that HIV/AIDS has in our present. We're not told, but it was diagnosed as a paternal strain. And when I told my father, finally, after I did heal, and we'll talk about that in a minute, he did say, no, it had to be a maternal strain. But in fact, it wasn't the paternal strain. But being the Brahmin that he wasn't going to take that into consideration. My mother being a Kshatriya from the Tamil South Indian, it most likely came from there. But doctor,
very quickly for our listeners, they may not know the words Brahmin or Kshatriya. Can you very quickly describe that?
Can you explain it? You're so good at that.
In Indian culture, although India is very secular politically, there still is the caste system, which comes with certain characteristics, attributes, much like the class system that we see in other parts of the world. And Brahmins are more knowledge seekers, they're more spiritual seekers, they become teachers. And Kshatriyas are the warriors who protect the land, who have the spirit of protecting the family, protecting the community, protecting the land. So obviously, Maya is talking to her genetic pool, which is she was born between the spiritual seeker and the protector, and that spirit kicked in.
It kicked in.
Is that what you say? Actually change your paradigm?
Yes.
Let me do all the conventional treatments that were available that day. And you obviously liked your physician. From what I hear, your physicians became your
guardians.
And then they had this therapeutic relationship with you. And you were reflecting on something which changed your paradigm. And I know reading your book and also talking to you that you went to Vermont.
Yes.
Why did you do that? You were given a death sentence.
That was a significant change. I realized that could not just tell I was very close to my father in particular, and there was no way I could actually tell him of the prediction. I didn't tell him that I had tell my family that I had cancer, nor did I tell them that I was given a death sentence. So I needed time to pause, and I needed time to collect myself, and I needed time to write that letter to my people. And my good friend Stella Adler had friends who had these cabins, ski cabins, and I went to one in Sugarbush, Vermont, a beautiful land of. The first thing I did when I came to America from Guyana in 1969, February, it was the huge snowfall, and it was the first time I saw snow. And somehow it called me again, and it was autumn going into winter in New York, and I went finally to Vermont. My good friend Stella and her friend, whose cabin it was, helped me set up basic things that I would need in it, showed me how to work the fire stove and how to get to the nearby store, which was all really pretty much farm stores, really beautiful. People still had a root cellar, for instance, in Vermont, where they kept the roots all winter long so safe and sound, in the pickling jars where they did all the pickling and kept it nicely again so that they can mm-hmm. move through the winter organically. Those things didn't lose my interest because I came from a place where my grandfather had more than 2,000 acres of farmland in the Quarantine Coast. And so going back there for me was solace to spirit. And there is something about the snow and everything is becoming rested underneath it. And you can hear the crispness of the sounds and the deer walking on the brambles and that crunchy sound that kaffa, so much love, became.
What is kaffa?
Kaffa is the water content in our body that describes the metabolic type, and we will of course explore that
later.
So
there's a classical element.
There's a classical element, the vata and pitta and kapha, vata being air predominantly, pitta fire, kapha water. And those of us with that luxurious kapha constitution to some extent, we need to feed that. So we're not only fed internally, we're fed externally. I was so lost inside that there was no way I could even look at a regimen for healing. It didn't even occur to me. The only regimen on my list was to go write a letter to my father and mother, let them know what was happening in the most compassionate way I can, tell them that they were losing their daughter, and also to come to terms with the chaos that I had left Guyana with and came to New York, and to look at the linkage between that chaos and my death, which for me, you know, I was not struggling and fighting to live. It was an interesting scenario. I really at one point thought it's so much easier to die. And I thought I would be given that, you know, clear route of escape, and went, of course, because of the staunchly embedded codes of honor with the divine that my father made sure he instilled in us, and probably from generations before, that many, many pujaris, priests in my lineage and gurus in the lineage in the spiritual way. But I think those things come to our aid. But it was so shocking because when I first got there, I loved the fire, I loved the snow. And I realized that whatever warmth I could get from that would help me. I wasn't thinking of living through it. I was given a death sentence and believed it. But I couldn't sleep, and I didn't really do a lot of sleeping. I spent a great deal of time, and I didn't have the stability to write as well. So I spent a great deal of time with a tape recorder and little cassette tapes. There were the classical cassette tapes. And started to pour out what I could share with no human ear. Just the ancient pain of a soul, I think, came out. I don't know what happened to those tapes, but I think I made over 50 or 60 recorded tapes. They were 60 minutes long in a little not-so-fancy recorder. But I told the story of what the unspeakable was in a culture that was supposed to be independent and then became driven with war.
Yeah.
And really, the incredible will of coming to terms with it by forging my way forward at the higher strata of life and not be caught as a victim anywhere, and that was my fight. At a very young age, I understood what it was to be victimized, an entire country, and it was not going to happen to me in the oasis of New York. I went from a village of 500 people to Greenwich Village in Manhattan with over a few million people. And I didn't first get to Greenwich Village. I was first sent to relatives in Queens, New York, the suburbs where lots of Guyanese Indians and Caribbean Indians and India Indians were, the hub, but understood that I couldn't bear that transition. Somehow for me it wasn't creative enough. And so how I came to Madison Avenue is yet another story, but the interesting thing is the driving force behind that was not to be victimized.
So are you saying that the great challenge you had, which was cancer, instead of that becoming the fear in your life, you somehow found an inner voice which showed you the strength with which to come alive?
I have had something happen more recently in my life that taught me that it was divine grace that rescued me. Because once we succumb to death, there is no longer a fear. It is trying to survive and live and succumb to the ability to live and live well and survive our challenges that bring in the terrain of fear, which is a natural part of the human experience. So for me, fear wasn't even anywhere about. I was still a warrior. I was still fighting my battle in a dialogue to myself on tapes. I was still voicing the impossible, the unspeakable, that we didn't have any listening time. We were all being packed up and exported to different universities and colleges by my brilliant father because he didn't want us to get caught in the worst years to come in Guyana.
Yeah.
And so what for me was happening is the writing of the letter took on many, many fangs and tentacles, the audio tapes being one of them. I would simply get out. I had a vehicle at the time. I did drive in New York. And I would simply get to the farmer's store and market and get all my roots, vegetable. I love carrots and beets. And that was the first time the purple potatoes was coming out as well. And I'd never seen purple potatoes. But anyway, I had them all chunked together in my big cast iron pot hung over the fire with water, and I would just put in salt and sometimes a little bit of sesame oil and just big cloves of garlic just like that in the pot and have it all cook itself. And fire isn't a very intelligent thing. The pot is even more intelligent, and the roots know exactly what to do. So I didn't spend a great deal of time finessing the menus I did over the latter years of my many books.
This actually really makes me laugh because it really interests me. My brain thinks completely differently. Like in any health situation, I would be looking at the nutritional background, carbohydrates, proteins, and fats, and what are the essential micronutrients and where are the minerals? I mean, which are all extremely important. But just listening to your journey, it feels like you went into nature, you retreated, and then you used nature and what was available in nature to nourish you.
Without so much as the conscious thought.
Without an app to calculate
your
carbs.
It was the memory, ancestral memory coming in underneath, sliding underneath me to give me ground when I was shifting and I had no ground whatsoever. And those ancestral memories are so powerful. And that's why I say to people, don't give up everything your ancestor ate. Don't give up everything your ancestor thought. Don't give up everything that they did, because we cannot be severed from the seamless energy of memory that comes and fuels us. Certainly we have to give up some of their behavior patterns and things that hold us back negatively, but we also have to put understanding to that as well, or else we never give it up. And then, so I really can't take, you know, so many people over the years have read my story and lauded me with so many compliments of being such a warrior. I survived cancer, but it was the Divine Mother who stepped in and helped. It was the ancestors who came and created ground where there was no ground. Because all of a sudden, without so much conscious thought, although it was consciousness, but it wasn't deliberate consciousness, I was putting together things that helped me. I couldn't, the cardinals lived on the bare branches, the white snow-laden branches in my window. I couldn't help but see the beauty of that. The deer just surrounded that cabin. They early morning would come and forage underneath, and I realized, oh my God, that's foraging. But I didn't, later I was to discover all of that in Pisgah Mountains in Asheville, North Carolina, where I built the Wise Art School. But then I didn't. I was just fascinated by the way that nature protects herself, provides, guards us. And many times in my, and I realized what was happening. The real thing that happened, and it took me years to understand this, is the subtle body was kind of unhinging from the physical body. As we die, that's what happens. Sometimes if we take a long time to die, that subtle body is slowly but progressively moving away from the gross body. And then you're in this vista that's like a light tunnel. And you're traveling, but you're not traveling in space and time as we know it. You're traveling in forward and backward from so many things. I saw my father reading the Bhagavad Gita so many times.
So that's a holy scripture.
One of the holy scriptures. And really just in his priest robe, his elder brother was the priest, but oftentimes he would try to educate the older brother. My father was quite incredible. Anyway, he would be in his robes, in his white robes, just reading the scriptures, and it was passages that talked about karma. I don't clearly remember exactly the passages, but I remember one thing he said afterwards is, you have enough prana, you can make it.
What is prana?
Breath force, life force. And I remember that very distinctly. You can make it, Maya. You have enough prana in your body. And then that was gone. And the next thing was this incredible blue bird. And there was no blue bird in the forest. It was a blue bird that appeared in a window that was not at the home. It wasn't the window of the home, but it was a window in my mind with a blue bird. And then she transformed into Mother Mary. And that was another vision. And I found that fascinating because as Hindus, as practicing Hindus at the time, you know, we have a pantheon of goddesses and gods, and Mary, Mother, the Divine Mother came in the form of Mary. And then later I saw Ganesh, the elephant god. But by that time I think I had already crossed over back into my gross body because I stopped traveling. I spent months, I think, traveling in between that subtle vista.
So the way I interpret this, Maya, is that there was this huge challenge of cancer and going through treatments and complications of it. And then you went back to retreat, which I think, you know, is a very important message for many of our listeners, because when there's a challenge, instead of panicking, take time. Take time to reflect, you know, try and find your roots, connections to nature, and don't worry too much about what to eat, what not to eat, but try and, you know, seek a lifestyle that's going to nourish you. That's the very first step that you did from what you're talking about.
Thank you for putting it like
and,
that.
And also you had this, listening. Through your journaling, you had this intense, emotional, psychological kind of a stirring that went through, which gave you certain lessons and perceptions. Not only that, what I hear from you, Maya, is that in that very challenging moment, instead of focusing too much on the problem, you started enjoying life around you.
Without thinking.
Without thinking.
The mind was not there. You see, when you're unhinged, the mind plays a much lesser role in our lives. And I'm not saying to people that as a lesson, go and get unhinged. But I am saying, let's take the pause. Let's put aside life as it normally is. Let us change circumstances if we can. If we have young families, it's very difficult. But we try to, if we can't create it from going into the mountains, going to the river, going into Mother Nature, into the bosom of her, let us create one room in our home that is that enclave, that sanctuary, that space that we can take pause in.
That's a very important message, because a lot of our listeners, including me, don't have the privilege to go into nature the moment we want to. So it's we live in cities, and so what you're saying is, instead of panicking, take a moment of pause to reflect what where you are at, and to connect with life.
To become embodied again.
Is this what you call creating the inner space?
The inner space has to be created. That is the number one protocol for healing that we have been applying and using for the last 35 years. especially with my with women who come to my programs and all of that. And I do have a penchant for women because of the ovarian cancer, surviving it, losing the womb, having an empty space that I had to fill, and I filled it with service. And it did enlighten, it did bring light back into a space that was very dark even when I had my womb. And so basically that took me into that space. So inner space, creating our own inner space, reclaiming who we are, not just as mother and sister and wife and husband and society of the member of a huge organization and all of that, but as the simple person of Maya or Katie or Deborah or John or
Vijay
or Vijay or Vijaya, whatever, and just to be and just to trust, because it's so hard to trust when there is fear. You know, what I say was my golden moment was having no fear, but then I had already accustomed myself to death. Now, we don't have to accustom ourselves to death to give up fear, because most of us don't want to just die. And if, had I to do over again, which I did have to do, not with cancer, with something else, I realized that in struggling to live, there is fear, and that is natural. We must accept fear as being natural so we can get beyond it. We can't fight fear because you'll be fighting for the rest of your life. So we accept the fear, we stay paused, we stay in that uncomfortable, gritty, sometimes nauseating space, but we have to stay there for a while and we have to accept that it is what it is. We can, you know, drink basil tea or lemon water or, you know, or licorice in our milk. We can do many things to assuage all of the feelings that we are having. We can take a good, wonderful massage with beautiful sesame, raw sesame oil. That's good for all constitution when it comes to massaging, or coconut, good raw coconut oil. And because, as you know, in the tradition of Ayurveda, it's called Sneha. And Sneha is not just lubricating, it means love.
It's a Sanskrit word for love.
For infusing love back into the tissue, into the skin, into the body, so that all the separationism that we have felt, the divisionism, because disease only comes from separationism and division, the conflicts of within our family, the conflicts within our life, the conflicts within ourselves. And once we can knit that back with Sneha, with the love, we are in a place that can be very magnificent during our trials and challenges. You see, these are simple recommendations that people ignore. We go into the regiments and we go into the books and we get inundated with huge amount of information, and then we get mentalized with the information, and then you become strapped straddled. You can't move because you have so much information piled at you and so many regimens that are already pre-thought. What about our own, the knowledge that comes from within us when we just sit and pause and be quiet and allow that inner space? I remember later on some things happened that just trapped me in the luxury of Vermont was that I was not trapped. I was entirely vast inside of me. I went beyond my body and spilled out into the heavens. But then something happened later from external forces that just caught me trapped and trapped and trapped and trapped. And then I realized, but we are vast inside. No matter how much we are being put upon, the inner space is absolutely vast, and we, through breath, through incredible nutrition, meaning from Mother Earth again, back to the wisdom of her nature and her seasons, we can expand that space.
So Maya, I like to remind our listeners that actually we are going to be talking about how to use food as medicine in the next episode. Talking to you, we will have Maya with us for 4 episodes, and we're going to go through the journey. And the very first episode was to understand Maya's journey and how, from being a very successful fashion designer to taking the path of healing herself and others, and how she changed was the main purpose of this episode. I'd like to ask you, Maya, in the next few episodes, we will talk about all the practical aspects. Is there a book that you can recommend to our listeners where you might be talking about some of the things that you have just discussed with me today?
Yes, I think the best book on this, because it tells a bit of my story through cancer and the time in Vermont, and it also gives the recommendation of incredibly simple things in terms of breathing and food and the luxury of simplicity that we can re-own and reclaim for ourselves. The book is called The Path of Practice.
The Path of Practice.
By Maya Tiwari, and it was produced by Ballantine Books, which is an imprint of Random House. And it's very much in print. So that would be a wonderful book.
Before we conclude today's episode, because we'll have you with me for three more episodes, we have quite a bit of time to look at the various aspects of how to actually overcome the challenges of illnesses or diseases, particularly cancer. If there is one message that you would say is pertinent to our listeners when they are faced with diagnosis of cancer, either in the family or amongst their friends or themselves, what would that be?
Cancer is a transformer. It transforms our life if we allow it to. It takes us over the bridge of the impossible. Because if we are hit with a disease, cancer or any other disease, it is because we are being forced by nature to pause and to stop and to reroute, to reevaluate and reroute. At one point, I was so thankful for being knocked off my feet, because at 16, to sustain this incredible business and then to put on this big performance and then to be so successful with my performance as a fashion designer, I was getting to be tired and I needed to reroute, but I didn't know that. And after cancer, I understood the blessings that it brought. So disease is an absolute transformer, if only we could look at it like that and not as a disease that's there to punish us.
Thank you so much, Maya, for the wonderful message that cancer is a transformer. We are going to be talking about food and various other ways how to deal with illnesses when we are faced with the challenge. To find more about Maya, you can go to www.wiseearth.com. It's wise as in wise, earth, E-A-R-T-H. Remember, there are two E's. It's wiseearth.com. Or you can go to mayatiwari.org, mayatiwari.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.